listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Shin Dong-hyuk escaped from a prison camp in North Korea, he couldn't have known his story would attract so much attention. He had been raised in starvation conditions and in human conditions, tortured countless times before he broke through the electric fence that surrounded the camp. And with extraordinary luck, he crossed the border into China and then lived as a refugee in South Korea. Blaine Harden, a reporter at The Washington Post, who was based in Southeast Asia, met Shin, the most prominent eyewitness to the existence of the North Korea prison system, and he tells Shin's story in Escape from Camp 14, which is published by Penguin. I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Harden to our show today. Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So what is Camp 14, and where in North Korea is it located, and does its number mean that there are at least 13 others?
No, its number is not significant. There are about six camps in the country now. Camp 14 is about 50 miles north of the capital, Pyongyang, and it's been there since about 1958. It's about 30 miles long, 15 miles wide. Now there are about 15,000 people in it.
Do we have to rely on things like Google Earth to even know where they're located and how many people might be in them?
Google Earth and Google Maps now really does help because the maps have there are real-time pictures being taken almost every week. And they show that in the past year, Camp 14 has actually expanded, as has Camp 25, which has doubled in size.
Do you think that's because of the change in regime?
That's the speculation. A third generation of a great leader is not going to make everybody in the country happy. And human rights groups believe that people who aren't happy and who've said so have been taken to camps.
What do we know of who is imprisoned and what they're charged with?
Well, in general, they're charged with being perceived political enemies of the state. They're not formally charged. They're arrested in secret, often in the middle of the night, along with their entire families. Collective punishment is the system, which means that if I were to say that Kim Jong-un, the current leader, is fat and incompetent, there's a very good likelihood that my children and my parents, along with myself, would go to a place like Camp 14 for the rest of our lives.
So people aren't released from these camps?
People aren't released from most of the camps. There's one camp, Camp 15, known as Yoduk, which has a rehabilitation zone, and people are released from it.
So even someone like Shin Dong-hyuk, who was born in the camp and who cooperated with the authorities at one point, he still would be there for the rest of his life?
Right. He faced no possibility of release. He cooperated with the authorities in order to eat.
Is he one of the few known escapees?
He is the only known escapee who's been born in the camps. There are two other escapees who were not born in the camp.
And how different are these camps from a Soviet gulag or a Nazi concentration camp?
I think the best analogy is the Soviet gulag. Kim Il-sung, the man who more or less invented North Korea, who arrived in the country as a Soviet captain in 1945, he was trained by the Soviets, and he was an acolyte of Stalin. Stalin invented the gulag, and the gulag in North Korea is modeled after it. But it's very interesting to know that the Soviet gulag lasted for about 25 years. The North Korean gulag is almost 60 years old and shows no sign of going away. In fact, it's expanding.
Why was Shin Dong-hyuk in the camp? I mean, he was born there. But what were the circumstances?
His crime was to have been born. His father was brought to the camp because his father's brothers had fled North Korea for the South in the wake of the Korean War. That was a crime, a collective crime punishable for the entire family. His mother was in the camp for reasons that Shin does not know. He asked his mother when he was growing up. She didn't tell him. Shin, by the way, is a creation of the guards who ordered his parents to have sex and who allowed his parents to have sex in something called a reward marriage. He was, in effect, bred by the guards.
So they didn't choose each other, his parents. They just simply, the guards said, okay, you and you.
That's right.
And why did they do that? Did they just want to have more people in the camp? Or they want them to have children?
Well, North Korea denies that the camps exist. So they do not publish an operating manual about why they do things. But the speculation from Shin and from others is there are two reasons. One is that good workers in the camp are rewarded with the opportunity to have sex. In Camp 14, there was an explicit rule that if you have sexual relations without authorization, you'll be shot. So young people who worked hard, and apparently Shin's father was a skilled worker as in a tool and die kind of machine, he was offered a woman to have sex with, and that's why Shin came into being.
And who are the guards? Are they out of the military?
The guards usually are chosen as they're the children of trusted security people. And they go through a very rigorous training in which they are taught that the people that they'll be supervising in the camps are not human beings, that they're enemies of the state. And they are allowed, under the rules, to abuse them, to rape them, and to murder them without punishment.
The inmates, I assume, have absolutely no contact with the outside world. Once they disappear, their relatives have no idea what's happened to them?
That's right.
Do people outside of the camps, in other parts of North Korea, have any idea that these camps even exist?
Yes. There have been social science surveys of the defectors who've crossed into China and who've arrived in South Korea over the past 10 years. And most of these defectors are aware of the camp's existence. The camps are really a Stalinist tool to keep a totalitarian state in line. And what they do is they do two things. They eliminate and isolate those few who are willing or crazy enough to question, oppose the regime, and they scare everybody else into silence.
Because it's my sense that many people, maybe the majority of people in North Korea, are true believers, that we may see them as deluded, but they actually believe in the things that the regime tells them, and that North Korea is one of the most advanced countries in the world.
Despite starvation. Yeah. To a certain extent, that's true. They are subject to a lot of propaganda, which says that the United States and South Korea and Japan are scheming to undermine the freedom and purity of the North Korean people. And they hear that from the beginning of their lives, and it's relentless. However, the North Koreans are not stupid. They can see that there's not much electricity. A third of the population is chronically hungry. And in the past 13, 15 years, since a catastrophic famine in North Korea turned the border with China into a semi-porous membrane, lots of food, clothing, and electronics have come into North Korea. And people have learned by listening to the radio, by watching CDs, that their country is, in fact, desperately poor. And that's a new development.
What were the circumstances that led Shin to snitch on his mother and brother?
It's really the saddest story that I've ever heard as a journalist. What happened was when he was 13 years old, he was living in a dorm not far from where his mother lived. He was going to a sort of boarding school in the camp. He was allowed to go home one night to have dinner with his mom. His older brother was there that night. His brother worked in a factory inside the camp.
Had his brother also been born in the camp?
Yes. But he hardly knew his brother because his brother was separated from the family when he was 11. They were 6 years apart. So Shin had dinner with his mom and dad, with his mom and brother that night. And then he was awakened around midnight by hearing his mom and brother discuss escape. The first rule of the camp is if you try to escape, you'll be shot. And the second rule is if you hear people talking about escape and fail to report it, you'll be shot. Shin was 13. He'd been raised by the guards to believe in these rules above anything else, over loyalty to his own family. He got up, told his mother he had to pee. He went outside and reported the plot to a guard.
And then his mother and brother were executed.
After 7 months.
In front of him.
In front of him.
And before she died, his mother tried to catch Shin's eyes, and he avoided looking back. But this has to have been one of the great psychological traumas of his life.
It was, and it is. What's interesting, though, is that when it happened, and for about a decade afterwards, he did not believe that he had done anything wrong. He had done what he'd been taught to do, which is follow the rules of the camp and increase his own chance for survival, of eating well. When he got out of the camp, he's learned in a sort of ex post facto way that what he did was morally horrible, and he's begun to feel increasingly guilty about it.
Well, it sounds to me like the culture of the camp is such that it's almost impossible to feel any friendship or compassion or love for anybody else in the camp.
Yeah. I ask him about love and friendship and trust a lot in our months and months of interviews. And the way he put it, learning about trust or love is like learning a very difficult foreign language. And he can sort of get his mind around the concepts, but they do not come in any way naturally to him.
Did he get any credit for snitching on his mother and brother?
Unfortunately, the soldier he snitched to did not tell his superiors that Shin had been the snitch. So Shin was taken to a prison inside the camp and tortured as a collaborator in this escape plan. After he'd been burned on the back and otherwise abused for several days, he managed to convince the guards that he had reported it. He had done his job as he understood it, and they allowed him to recover.
What kind of upbringing did he have? Did he have any education?
His education was such that he could read and write at a rudimentary level, and it was a functional literacy so that he could work in factories. His probably his most challenging job in the factory was working in a uniform factory fixing manual sewing machines.
Was he a true believer in the regime, as other North Koreans are? How aware was he of the Kim family?
He was not aware. Because he was an irredeemable, someone who was slated to be worked to death inside the camps, he was not taught about the regime. He did not know, really, who the great leader and the dear leader were. He only found out about them later, after he got out.
His mother and brother had been killed for trying to escape, and yet he decided to try as well, with little knowledge, in fact, no knowledge of what lay ahead.
Right. What happened, he was 23. He was working in this uniform factory fixing sewing machines. He was asked to snitch on a newcomer to the camp, a man named Park, and also teach him how to fix sewing machines. But in the process, 6 weeks of walking around with Park, they began to talk about the outside world. Park was an individual of a kind that Shin had never met before, someone who'd been educated in Pyongyang and abroad in the former Soviet Union and traveled in China. And they talked, and Park gave Shin a primer on planet Earth. He told him, broke the news to him that the world was round, that China and the United States existed. He told him a little bit about the Kim family. But Shin was bored with all of this. He wasn't interested in the Magna Carta or human rights. When Park started talking about grilled meat in China and how if one were to get there, you could eat all you wanted, Shin started to dream about grilled meat, and within a few weeks, he asked Park to escape with him.
What had happened to Shin's father when his mother and brother were executed?
His father was also taken to the prison inside the camp, tortured, and his leg was badly broken, and he never quite recovered from that. But then his father was not executed and went back to camp life. Just before Shin escaped, he had a last supper with his father.
But didn't tell his father what he was planning.
He didn't tell him what he was planning for two reasons. He didn't trust his father, and he didn't want his father to know in case, which he expected would almost certainly happen in case his father was tortured after he escaped.
My guess is Blaine Harden. His book, Escape from Camp 14, was a New York Times bestseller when it was published in hardcover. Now it's available in paperback with a new afterword, and it is published by Penguin. The new afterword because of the changes that have occurred in North Korea since the book was published?
Yes, it talks a little bit about the changes in North Korea, but not all that much has changed in North Korea, other than in the past few weeks there's been an extraordinary level of threats.
Well, we have a third dear leader, or is he even called dear leader?
It's not clear what his moniker is going to be. He has been called the young general and a gift from heaven. But the afterword is mostly about what's happened to Shin since the book was published, and also what's happened to the human rights question as perceived by the international community.
So how would you how did he escape? I mean, others must have known that you could get past the electric wiring. And I'm sure many have gotten out, but then they're usually caught before they can go very far. Or they're caught in China and sent back, aren't they?
That's true. It's those who don't make it. The reasons they don't make it are unknown. What's known from Shin's story is that he and Park formulated a pretty lame escape plan, which was to get near the electric fence that surrounds the camp, wiggle through it, and run off to China. On this escape plan, Shin was to have gotten to the fence first. He didn't get there. He slipped in the snow. Park got there first and was electrocuted climbing through the fence. Shin used Park's body as kind of an electrical pad and climbed over his body and got out of the camp.
And then he had to get to the Chinese border, and then he had to survive in China, and then he had to find his way to South Korea. All of these things are incredibly difficult.
Incredibly difficult. He was incredibly lucky. It's almost impossible to overstate how lucky he was. When he went through the fence, he didn't know which way was north. But he's also very tough, very smart, with an uncanny sense of self-preservation. And he managed to find his way out of the country. One of the things that his escape through North Korea, and he was out in about 30 days, and he traveled about 370 kilometers in 30 days. He was out because in North Korea, there's a sort of slipstream of smugglers and traders moving goods around. And that is the economy of North Korea. He fell in with these guys. He was dirty, ill-clothed, ill-kept, and he fit right in. And with them, he found his way in a truck and in a train to the border.
And then he had to get through all of China to get to South Korea.
Right. He worked in China as a cowherd for about a year, saved his money, found some Chinese-looking clothes to wear. He traveled and kept his mouth shut and found his way to Shanghai, where he lucked in a restaurant into a meeting with a South Korean journalist who took him to the South Korean consulate, where he received diplomatic protection and where he stayed for 6 months before he came to South Korea.
Well, he would be a real coup for the South Korean government, wouldn't he?
He was. The information he offered to South Korean intelligence and to U.S. Army intelligence about how the camps operate was new. They'd never spoken to anyone born in the camps before. They didn't know that children were being bred in the camps as workers.
How did you come to meet him?
I was working for the Washington Post trying to find distinctive stories to explain North Korea beyond the bluster about missiles and nuclear weapons.
Well, there must have been a culture shock when he went to China. First of all, a culture shock just getting out of that prison.
Right.
Then a culture shock in China. And then when he winds up in South Korea, which is far from it's always had a little bit of an oppressive side to the government, but nothing like what he had in the North. It must have been totally overwhelming for him.
I ask him about the culture shock a lot, and I assume that it would be technology that was the big shock. But is the biggest shock
Samsung, the largest producer of smartphones in the world.
Tall buildings, fast cars, television. That's what I thought. But what he said was the biggest shock was his first day outside the camp. He slept in a pigsty in a small town called Bukchang, which is very near the camp. He woke up in the morning and walked around in this town of North. It was dirty. It was cold. But he saw people who weren't being hit by guards, who were wearing colorful clothing, and who were laughing. And for him, the idea that human beings could live like that was the greatest revelation of his life.
Well, how long did it take him to get to the point where he could try to establish human relationships? Start dating, for example.
He describes it as a process. He says, I am learning how to be a human being, and it is going very, very slowly. I met him 4.5 years ago. And I would say at that point, he was not very far along in the process. He had the coldest eyes of anyone I'd ever met. He was distant and easily angered. He seemed like somebody who had been severely traumatized and had not gotten close to getting over it. He's much better off now. The success of this book and his international travels as a kind of celebrity of the camps has sort of validated for him the importance of his experience in explaining to the world what goes on. It's made a big difference in his emotional balance.
Since he's the only escapee from such an impenetrable prison system, and North Korea is well known for having kidnapped people and killed people who they outside of their own boundaries, does he ever fear for his life?
Yes, I think it's a legitimate fear at this point. North Korea has, in the past 3 years, tried to kill defectors who it was unhappy with. They've succeeded in one case in 1997. A relative of Kim Jong Il's former wife was assassinated in the streets of Seoul. But Shin says that it's a risk that he's quite willing to put up with, and it's not going to silence him.
North Korea is in the news this week with new threats. What's your take on it?
I guess the first answer is who knows why North Korea does whatever it does. But I think the best reason is that Kim Jong-un is only 30 years old.
But so is Shin, isn't he? They're about the same age?
Yeah. They sort of represent the alpha and omega of opportunity in that country. One's above the law and one does not exist legally. But it seems that Kim Jong-un is trying to consolidate his power with his own constituency, which is the elite in the country and, to a lesser extent, the people in the country.
Well, since the country is so isolated and all the West can do is apply sanctions, does it really have much of an impact on the way the North Koreans conduct their business?
No. And the reason sanctions mean so little to North Korea is China. China is by far the overwhelming, most important trading partner. Trade with China has exploded in the past 10 years. North Korea actually has a trade surplus right now, which is very interesting. And the reason for that surplus is because it is very rich with minerals that China is interested in, one of which is rare earth metals, which is used in high-tech manufacturing.
Are you aware of the story of the Chinese journalist who was fired because he suggested that China cut ties with North Korea, that it wasn't in its best interest?
Yeah, I've heard about that. But I think there is a debate, an emerging debate in the highest levels in China now about, is it in China's best interest to be a partner with a state that is increasingly behaving in a way that's perceived as nutty?
On the other hand, a letter to today's New York Times suggests that the nature of the military exercises by the U.S. and South Korea should not be ignored as provocations to Kim Jong-un's new government because they involve computer-related invasion plans.
You know,
behind every paranoid thought, there may be some justification.
Right. Americans should know, I think, that the paranoia of North Korea is based on reality. During the Korean War, 1950 to 1953, the United States bombed North Korea in just an incredibly vicious way. About 85% of the structures in North Korea were reduced to rubble, and more than 1 million people were killed, civilians. The memory of that savage bombing campaign is very much alive in the hearts of every North Korean because it's in the interest of the state to keep that memory alive. And when North Koreans hear about war games with South Korea, when they hear that B-2 bombers are overflying the Korean Peninsula, they hearken back to the memory of the Korean War, and it genuinely frightens them.
On the other hand, they were one of the three countries cited in the so-called Axis of Evil by David Frum. We invaded Iraq despite the fact that North Korea has nuclear arms. We have never attacked them. So do they feel that their policies are effective?
I think they feel that their deterrence is effective, and they see long-range missiles and nuclear bombs as part of that deterrence. But the deterrence is real, and it's real because of World War II technology, mostly because of artillery guns, thousands of them on the north side of the DMZ pointed at Seoul. If North Korea were to decide to use that artillery, there is nothing that the U.S. or South Korea could do to avoid perhaps tens of thousands of casualties in Seoul.
Blaine Hardin is a contributor to PBS's Frontline and The Economist. He served as the Washington Post bureau chief in East Asia, Eastern Europe, and Africa. And he's the author of the New York Times bestseller Escape from Camp 14, now available in paperback from Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.